Facebook side of things as well. So it takes a little bit of, you know, jiggery pokery. Haven't worked out how to automate this, so it's still a bit of a mess. But you know what? Amateur hour. This is what Brain Food Live is all about,
you are,
man.
You are nothing but an amateur. It's real and it's live and it's fun, right?
Complete amateur. Anyway, we are live. So welcome, everybody, to Brain Food Live on air. This is episode 55. I'm delighted to be with you today. We're going to be – it's actually a part of a double header today. So I'm going to be not only on we're on now, but we're going to be on later on this afternoon as well. We're going to do two shows with a half-an-hour break. So it's going to be a fantastic afternoon of – broadcasting and entertainment, hopefully. And just before we kick off, I just wanted to give a quick shout out to our sponsors this week. Our sponsors are, in fact, BAME Recruitment. They are a recruitment business that is all about trying to create a more inclusive and diverse talent pool when you're looking to build your business. I'm really pleased to see this type of organization emerge, actually. It's very important, I think, that we see kind of organizations on the agency side really take some ownership of this piece and not just relying on kind of internal or HR folks to be part of this. It's a problem that all parts of the recruitment industry, I think, need to get involved with. So fantastic to have BAME Recruitment sponsoring us today. Some housekeeping before I begin. Firstly, apologies for what seems to be like a super laggy video here. I don't know why that is the case. I'll try and fix that as we go. But for all of the people, we're multi-streaming this again, as we usually do. We're on Crowdcast. So if everyone can hear me on Crowdcast, can you please just comment on the chat stream and say, I can hear you, Hung. Just make sure that's the case. We had some massive audio problems just before we launched. Same for you guys on LinkedIn. So if you're on LinkedIn right now and you're watching the live stream, just a quick comment, please, to say, yes, Hung, I can hear you. And I believe we're Facebooking it as well today. So folks who are listening on the Facebook group, if you can just comment very quickly, you can hear you, that'll be fine. Zoe, Vicky, Nick, thank you very much. That's very kind of you. Okay, looks like we're ready to go. Anyway, super excited today because once again, Adam Gordon has been upgraded. This is an ongoing project of mine. And I don't always nail it because oftentimes he appears, but you know, now and again, I managed to get an upgrade. And today I'm delighted because I do have an upgrade. It's Luke Davis. Luke, how are you doing, man?
I'm good. Thank you, Hung. Poor old Adam. He gets upgraded a lot, doesn't he? I feel for him.
He sets a very low bar, so it's not that difficult, to be honest with you. But yeah, it's like you still have to ask people, don't you? and they can still say no. So Luke, great to have you on the show. And you are, in fact, the part owner, I think, of BAME. Is that right? Tell us a little bit about that and also about Diversify.io, because that's how we – because I think we used to know each other from your previous incarnation working at Elements, and then you moved on to work in this business and actually set up a new platform, didn't you, Luke?
Exactly right. Yeah. So I'm coming up to 20 years in recruitment and talent in May. And I guess I've had quite a few incarnations in that time. We got to know each other through the work I was doing at Elements. They're helping a lot of kind of fast scale tech organizations and corporates that were trying to hire and hire at speed. But I guess, I suppose, as I've got older, my moral conscience, my social conscience, my desire to take the talent and recruitment skills that I've picked up over the years, because I've done a lot of agency work, big agencies like Robert Half and Randstad, a lot of kind of RPO outsource work. So, you know, my kind of mission now is like, how can I bridge that gap between, you know, candidates and employers, because I think there is a gap there. And the business BAME Recruitment is one that my wife set up up to 5 years ago. And it was because she felt there was a lack of representation in the organizations that she worked in. And gradually over time, it's been a kind of a part-time thing for me. But as this is taking longer and longer and longer, and I have kind of personal reasons as well, coming from a mixed race family, that I just feel like I had to do more. So fully full-time now with Cynthia, but also created a platform called diversifying.io, which is effectively a careers platform where organizations can reach out and speak authentically to people from communities maybe they're not currently resonating with. And that's kind of one of the big issues or the big disconnects that I see in this D&I challenge that we've got.
Yeah, absolutely. And massively important. I've got to be honest, I kind of approached D&I pretty much from an ignorant point of view, which kind of ironic given the fact that I am an ethnic minority, right? But I just walked through life without necessarily encountering any visible challenges as far as I could discern. So I do sort of take ownership of the fact I don't know. So this is going to be a fascinating topic for us today, because we've got yourself with this background. We've got Torrin Ellis coming on the show later in a couple of minutes with Julianne Sowash as well coming in. All folks, I think, that have got a real passion for this this piece and have got solutions as well. So I'm very excited to hear more about that. But before we begin, we always do a quick review of recruiting brain food from last week. So a quick one on the newsletter, Luke. Did you read it? And if so, was there anything interesting that you saw?
I did read it. And there was also, I suppose, one article in particular and a couple of funnier ones that really resonated with me. And I think the big one, and this is something that's been on my mind loads at the moment as we kind of adjust to this reality and think about what reality we're going back to, is that the five levels of remote work and why you're probably at level two.
Right.
I thought it was an amazing article and an interesting starter for what I've been seeing around, like, some people that are used to remote working, some people that, I suppose, this is the first time some of them had video interviews, and this feeling that kind of most of us have literally taken everything that we do in the office and we've literally kind of put it onto video. And I don't know about some people, but I'm feeling really zoomed out or hangouted out or whatever it might be at the moment, and kind of thinking again around how do we rebuild work to suit kind of what we want rather than just taking what we did in the office and putting it onto video.
And that's actually, you know, a really popular post. I've just shared it in the chat stream on Crowdcast, by the way. So if you haven't read it, please do so. And it's all about trying to kind of, it does create a bit of a hierarchy, which I thought, maybe some people get a nose put out a little bit on this. But it was useful because it did tell you, actually, there's some people that are quite new to this, and that's okay. But you've got to understand that just because you're doing these Zoom calls, it doesn't mean that you know about remote working in an optimal way. Particularly, what resonated with me on this was these mass Zoom calls you saw, you know, where everyone in the business happened to be in it, and you think nothing's going to get done in that call. There's like 40 people on it. By the time you've gone through the introductions and who is what, you've burnt like 3 hours of time. This is not how you should really do it, and you learn it as you go, as we're discovering. You can't really be productive in this way. But that article, I think, was really, really important because it just break it down and can give you and your organization a bit of a benchmark to say, okay, this is where we're at and where we've yet to go.
Yeah, big time. And I think that was then what kind of like tickled me about the next one of the other articles was there was the man who had created a digital AI powered tool for his video calls, which I thought was epic. Because like, if I was having to sit on one of those with 100 people, being able to get like an AI twin to take that call for me, that would have been, off the charts. So it was a funny one. That
was great. So for people who don't know what Luke's talking about here, but it's basically this guy, creative technologist, he calls himself, but basically he just uses tech to create interesting things, not necessarily useful, but this was interesting and potentially useful because it was like literally, I think, creating a bunch of screenshots of his of how he would appear on Zoom, stitching it together in some sort of GIF, and then have that respond to questions that he could pre-program. And it was like, if you're stuck in a huge meeting that literally there's no reason for you to be in, just deploy the bot and the bot can take care of it for you. Very funny. Again, I've just shared it in the chat stream there. Great story. And also, you know, I think a sign of the innovation that's there to come, you know, I mean, it right now it's a joke, but you can imagine having a remote or a robot avatar representing your position could potentially be okay in some circumstances. Like, let's say you're there purely to be interrogated for factual information. You could be there and say, these are my positions. So that's not contextual. This is the position I hold. Could potentially just be, a resource the other chat members could make use of. You know, you can imagine, for instance, let's say you've got somebody who isn't necessarily a driving contributor to the conversation, but may have some reference knowledge or something that you might say, hey, is this true? You know, that kind of question. And this AI could give you that information. Yes, it's true. Or no, I don't know. Something like that. So interesting experimentation on technology. Okay, one more, Luke. What else was interesting for you?
Well, the other one was one that kind of, I suppose, really hit me personally because having been in tech recruitment for a long time, coming up to 20 years, my first ever placement was for a COBOL programmer back in 2000. And I literally fell off my chair when I saw one of my buddies who posted this on LinkedIn, and then I saw it in your share, which was around, it was the New Jersey State who had a very old legacy system that dealt with unemployment insurance, and they needed to get hold of COBOL programmers because they hadn't changed their mainframes. And I thought it really tickled me, but also I suppose it was a real lesson in, I saw a lot of people who had COBOL skills that were then out of work for a very long time and left the industry, et cetera. So it was interesting to see that kind of choice around, do you diversify your skill set, or actually do you stay really deep in something?
That's a good technique. And you know what? I'm the same age as you, I reckon. I knew the COBOL programming world. Hands up, by the way, anybody who's watching on this, any of these chat streams, have you ever recruited a COBOL programmer? COBOL kicks DB2. Do you remember that mainframe jive? Yes, I do indeed. And there was a big move, actually, for everyone to cross-train COBOL programmers into Java. This is like the pre-Java age. And then everyone thought, right, Java is going to be the thing that's going to be powering all of these banking systems. But of course, there's a lot of legacy systems that you can never strip out that stayed with COBOL. You know, these are things that are 24/7, 365 days a year. There's no downtime. You can't possibly say, oh, we're going to take 2 hours downtime in order to deploy this new software in Java, because that may be a couple of billion quid of transactions that simply stop happening. So typically in banks, in I think a lot of utilities, anything that basically was built in the 70s, 80s, that kind of time, is still running COBOL. And of course, nowadays, there's less and less of them, simply because there is like natural attrition. I'm sorry to say, people are actually dying that used to be programming. This is, you know, these guys have been doing it, and it is all guys, I think. You know, back in those days, there was talking about diversity, there was like zero diversity there. And it was, this is now the programmers who were programming then must now be 50, 60, even older. So there's an attrition there, retirement, people pass on. It's not a popular technology for young people. Everyone wants to learn JavaScript, Python, all the rest, COBOL, people are leaving behind. So there's less and less. And of course, now the demand is so high is that they can actually charge a significant premium for their services. This is a must-have talent. You know, you must have this person doing it. And yeah, it's one way to stay secure in the future, right? I mean, the current advice is to say everyone needs to be agile and diverse and being able to pick up new skills and all the rest of it. Always keep up to date with skills. Actually, developers are very keen on this. If you're recruiting for software, you would know that having the latest tech stack is one of the reasons why, you know, you should do it, is because it's attractive to developers. You want to constantly upskill. But here is an example where you can simply say, you know what, just double down on what you know. Stick with it. And if that technology persists, then actually your market value can increase simply because the labor supply is going to decrease through natural attrition. Anyway, a very, very interesting, kind of funny, maybe important blog post I've just shared in the chat stream. So it's an interesting one to review. I'm sure there's recruiters out there that think the same, you know, like the cold caller brigade, which I'm generally a critic on, but I do wonder, you know, are there intrinsic skills of a recruiter that have lost fashion for whatever reason, but still, you know, it may survive downturns because there's always going to be a segment that needs this. And yeah, that person is going to keep trading, you know?
Yeah, completely. It's fascinating. And as someone that I always worried about that period, because I saw people that were doing so well and then out of work and then having nowhere to go to, it made me always want to kind of retrain or reskill. Yeah. So yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? Definitely a blog post.
Okay, great stuff, Luke. Topic of today is as a topic, of course, where you built your business, you and your wife, and also about, it's also related to the COVID pandemic as well, it has to be said. So all of this is about, if there is a systems reset, you know, if there is some sort of, if the future looks different from what it was before, you know, there's no rubber bound bounce back, it will be a very different society, different companies, different processes, different things. What would you say would we do differently with regards to D&I? If we had that chance and opportunity, because it seems to me that there's been a lot of intractable challenges here that with all the will and all of the effort, they're still very persistent. but perhaps, you know, COVID-19 and this lockdown and this, you know, complete change that we've all kind of encountered, does it give us an opportunity to change it fundamentally? And if so, what would you change? So I'll ask you that question now before I bring Torin and Julianne on, and I'm going to ask them the same thing. So I'll give you the first shot at answering that, Luke.
Yeah, cool. Thank you, Hung. And I guess one of the main reasons for me kind of doing this full time was to kind of get closer to it and to be able to see every day, you know, kind of what was getting in the way from talent functions. Why are people struggling or finding it difficult? And I guess the role that I see that I can play in this is that I think there's certain things around the processes and the structures that we have built to solve other problems that are getting in the way of D&I. For example, I think, like, you know, this obsession that we've had over the years, and I think it's to a lesser degree in certain companies and others, but things like time to hire, for example, absolutely gets in the way of diversity hiring. Like, that does not, the two things don't translate to run a fair and proper process, engaging lots of different communities and how you do that. That's not a fast thing. So getting your hiring community, your hiring managers to kind of just slow down a bit, I think could have a really, really, really big impact. Other point that I see a lot as well is just, you know, this kind of like over obsession that we've had on short-term statistics. Like, I think, you know, we've clearly got to measure what progress looks like, but I think we've kind of backed people into a corner where they're almost ashamed to talk about what the data's saying and what the statistics are saying. And I think it's making people defensive. It's making commercial organizations not want to talk about it. And I think an acceptance where we stop blaming, but then work together on progress, I think this is another kind of like really, really big thing that's getting away. So it's kind of taking some of the traditional and stripping it back.
Are you referring, in the second point, are you referring to diversity data, diversity metrics?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's deal with those two points first. Number one, I think you're right. Some of the KPI data doesn't help D&I because, you know, that's all about optimizing for efficiency, optimizing for, you know, the profit at the end of the day. And we've seen sort of where that's led us in many respects with the COVID pandemic. We recognize we've over-indexed a little bit on this, and maybe we need to have a little bit more of a less efficient way of doing it, but nonetheless is more resilient. And there's no question at D&I is one of those things that have been left on the wayside as a result of this pursuit, over pursuit of efficiency. And the second point, you're talking about data being used as a shaming tool. I can see that how that can be difficult because it means that it may not be the best motivator for action. You know, if people feel pressured to do something, on the one hand, I can see it's a good thing because some organizations maybe do require this. But on the other, you can also see that it doesn't seem to be a sustainable motivator. It's almost like, you know, when you're managing someone, you can manage them through fear and all the negative stuff. You might get some short-term action, but deep down, they're not going to change their behavior in any great way. But if you find a positive motivator, that you can actually find a more sustainable way of progress. Super interesting, man. Super interesting. Okay, cool. Listen, we're going to keep talking on this track, but let's bring on Torin and Julianne because I'm really keen to speak to these two. They're individuals that, you know, I've had the good fortune of getting to know a little bit over the last couple of years or so, and they've got some super ideas generally on recruiting, but, you know, specifically on this topic, which... you know, I'd be interested to share these ideas and get the audience to have a look. Oh, by the way, whilst we're getting Torin and Julianne on, what I can say to you is if you're watching this on Crowdcast and you have a question for any of the guests, please ask them in the Ask a Question feature. That's the place where basically we can go to it at the end of the show and we can make sure that we've got the information that you need. So if you've got any questions for Torin, Julianne, or Luke, just please ask them there. And there they are. Goodness me, better looking than you and I. look at these two here. You know, well dressed, so cool. Well turned out, everything. Julianne, let's go with you. For the people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself and who you are and what do you do?
Sure. My name is Julie Sowash. I am the Executive Director of Disability Solutions. And you can think of us really as like a nonprofit RPO for companies that want to hire talent with disabilities, including veterans with disabilities and all types of disabilities really across the board. I'm also lucky enough to be the co-host of the Crazy and the King podcast with our guest here, Torin Ellis. And I am also a person with a disability. I have multiple mental illnesses that I will live with for the rest of my life. And I'm really happy to be here.
Great to have you, Julie. And Torin, for the people who don't know you, do you want to quickly introduce yourself and who you are and what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. And good morning to both you, Nick, and of course to my pod partner, Julie. Absolutely love her. Diversity strategist, risk mitigator, have a show on SiriusXM, heard by millions of individuals each and every Sunday afternoon. I get inside of organizations and I help them optimize their recruiting strategy through the lens of leadership and a genuine commitment to diversity and inclusion. And I'm happy to be with you. And of course, you already understand, we get ready to have a fire show.
Yep, absolutely, man. Absolutely. Really excited to have you both on. And the question that we've kind of set this show on, and by the way, it's more of a guideline than anything else, but I thought it was interesting to sort of look at this topic through the lens of your pre-COVID, post-COVID type of idea, because it seemed to me that there was a lot of intractable problems, if you like, with diversity and inclusion. Like, there seemed to be a lot of goodwill, like everyone wanted to do something about it, but you know what? The problems seemed to be very persistent. They seemed to not go away in any substantive way. And I just thought, you know what, if we could push the reset button on all of it, how we do recruitment, how would we rebuild recruitment so that it removes some of these issues or at least ameliorated them in some way? And, you know, I was thinking that in the post-COVID world, maybe this is a moment where that gives us the opportunity to do that. So that's the question. If you could push the reset button on recruitment per se, how would we rebuild it so that diversity and inclusion, some of these problems that we've persistently had, start to go away? Judy, do you want to give this a shot?
Yeah, I mean, from I think fundamentally we have to start with a reset on D&I, on what counts as D&I. One thing that you'll hear me harp on a lot are meaningless PR activities, awards, lack of measures, lack of transparency. And I think until we kick those pieces out and D&I really becomes kind of an elite club of companies that are doing it well and are doing it for business-driven purposes, we'll continue to have the same problems in recruitment. And, you know, from a recruitment perspective, we need to have measures, and we also need to really understand how the vendors that we're working with impact our ability to be diverse. And kind of the last piece that I think is really important is we also have to understand the value that we place on labor and where that labor sits in our organizational hierarchy and how that impacts our diversity and inclusion. Because we put a moral value judgment on someone's level within an organization or within a society, and that drives so much bias that's part of our current recruitment system that we have to reset that value proposition.
Can you give us an example of that, Julie? I think you've got something in your mind when you talk about how the hierarchy of value of different types of labor. For the audience point of view, can you give them a little bit of an example of what you mean by that?
Yeah, sure. So we're going through it right now with essential workers. There is so much value to that cashier, to that truck driver, to those nurses, teachers. And because they make less money or they have less ability to create more revenue than the way, at least in America, we have that societal moral judgment on them of their value within our system overall. And when women, Black and brown people, disabled people, LGBTQ people are in those lower levels, we start to associate their value based on where they sit in that hierarchy. Jeff Bezos is no more important or more valuable than the person who packs the boxes at Amazon, but because he is much more wealthy, he then gets that extra value because of his wealth.
You know what? That's a really interesting way of thinking about it. And now that you've mentioned it, I'm beginning to just cycle through the sort of roles that exist within a business. And, you know, the organogram, as we see it, is all clearly a hierarchy, and we apply the values accordingly. And it is based on revenue, isn't it? We think that the guy or the girl who makes the most money is the best person, most valuable person, and yet they may not be the most critical individual in that company. Maybe the IT person, for instance, or it could be the office manager or somebody without whom the business cannot operate. But because they're not visibly, at the glamour end of revenue generation, they don't get that reward socially or materially. And of course, there's a demographic sort of outcome to all of that as well. Okay, cool. Well, I'd like to revisit this actually, Julie, but let's go to you, Torin. Push the button, man. Reset a recruitment, let's say. We're going to just do it all from scratch, throw away stuff we don't want and rebuild things that we do. What would you do to ensure that we have a more inclusive and diverse way of hiring?
Yeah, so I'm going to try to take aim at the conversation. I'm going to hit a couple of different targets, and I'm going to pick up on the one that Julie just left when we talk about people that are frontline employees, grocery store workers, hospital aides, orderlies, just a variety of individuals that in the past 65 days ago, we really didn't pay any attention to. And it's really important for us to understand that, you know, when Julie says black and brown people, just as a data point, something like 39% of jobs that are held by black and brown people are in those positions. And they feel like a large number of them are going to struggle and suffer through this COVID pandemic. And so here's what I want. I would want that we be honest. I don't think that we've had enough honesty when we think about diversity and inclusion. I hear you, Hung, when you say that the will has been there. I would actually push back. I don't believe that the will has been there. We've had a number of people here and there and here and maybe over there, but we've never had a really substantive effort towards diversity and inclusion in many organizations. We're not willing to be honest in that regard. We're willing to throw up a press release. We're willing to put some money into a nonprofit organization. We're willing to show up in the community and build a couple of houses and say we did what we were supposed to do to give back. But we're not really going through the organization. And I mean, in every single business unit and department, looking at how D&I, equity and belonging, shows up in the organization. I said from RecFest last summer, June 2009, quote, you cannot get, if you haven't gotten diversity right when everyone was coming to the office, how in the hell are you going to get it right when everyone is working out of the office? Look at where we are now. So the bottom line is we got a lot of work to do. We have to be honest with where we are. And the only way that we're going to be able to come out of COVID-19 and change what it looks like going forward is we got to be honest as to how do we get to where we are right now? Like right now, look at everything. We got to look at everything outside of the workplace and then look inside of the workplace. We say all the time, bring your whole self to work. But we're not paying attention to the fact that folks got issues that they got to deal with outside of work. So we got a lot of work to do. If I were to blow it up, what I would do is I would make sure that every organization has the chief diversity officer, whomever that person is, or whatever that title is, reporting directly to the CEO. That person would have an individual inside of every business unit and or department in the organization that reports to them. And then we would hold every last one of them accountable, period. That's what we would do.
Great stuff, Torin. Luke, I mean, feel free to pop in with a comment or observation anytime, but I just wanted to key on a theme that both Julie and Torin mentioned, which was this concept of honesty or lack thereof. You both feel that this has been the case in the conversation in D&I. In other words, there's been some gestures performative type of things that basically would give people the PR, but not substantive change. Why do you think that lack of honesty has occurred? And how do we get to the position of honesty? I mean, all right, so let's say there is a scenario where people feel obligated to do something and in a performative way. How do we move that person or that organization to the point where they feel they can go and it's time to have that honest conversation? And indeed, what is that honest conversation? I'd love to hear all of your thoughts on that. Luke, can I go to you with this? Just a quick comment on this before we circle it around.
Yeah, definitely. And this kind of ties into my point around the things that we do going forward is to discourage this defensiveness or this kind of hiding behavior that goes on at the moment. And it's, I don't know if it's the right way of explaining, but it's almost like creating an amnesty where people can just get it out there and hold their hand up and say, look, you know what, I have failed. Yeah, you know, I said the right things. Yeah, you know what, that was a PR exercise if I really kind of like I'm true and honest with myself, and get it all out. No blame, no like kind of like, you know, point pinning the finger on, and all come forward again together, knowing that we've failed in wherever we've got to today, but knowing it's going to be different moving forward. And I completely agree with Torin, like get that D&I person to report to the CEO. I mean, there's a great comment that's just come in saying it would even say that maybe the chief diversity officer should be the CEO, you know, kind of like have it all the way through the organization would be the ideal state.
On that note, before I forget, but how far, we're miles away from this, right? Like a chief diversity officer, I could not name someone or even a company that has this position. Are there examples that we can look to and say, this is an example of a person or a business that has this this role in the right position for things to happen?
Yes. So I want to pick up on Luke's point just for a moment. I love how he framed it in amnesty. I love that. Like, I absolutely think that I need to steal that and figure out how to use that language, you know, over the next couple of days, Luke. That was truthful right there. But what I think, you know, I think about Larry Fink. Larry Fink put out his annual letter to CEOs in December of 2018. And what he said to them, he runs BlackRock. BlackRock's $6 trillion investment firm, probably the largest on the planet, if not the largest, certainly in the top three. What he said in that annual letter to CEOs in December of 2018, and I'm paraphrasing it, is that diversity and inclusion has to be something that's important to you, and we're going to hold you accountable for such. We're going to hold you accountable. Well, you understand that people embraced it, but there were a number of people, from politicians to news broadcasters to other corporate leaders, who accused him of using his perch to advance a personal initiative. They accused him of corporate socialism because he wants D&I, corporate socialism. So that's the bullshit that we got to deal with. We got to make sure that we get rid of the individuals that don't see inclusion as a competitive business advantage, as something that helps us to grow the organization. We have to make sure that we minimize and mitigate those individuals inside of our organizations. I'm not saying we got to push them out, but their voice cannot be the compelling and the largest and longest voice in the organization. There's too much research out there that says when we have diverse and inclusive organizations, we do a far better job. Example, if we have recruiters that are watching your broadcast right now, Hung, I guarantee you we have some incredible individuals in this chat room. Incredible. Talented. But if I stuck a person next to one of them that was blind and they started to work on a search, it immediately changes where they look, how they converse, how they strategize. It changes everything just sticking a blind recruiter next to anybody inside of our chat room. That's what we need. So we got to make sure that we are honest about moving forward and holding individuals accountable. Final point, Nzinga Shaw. You want an example? I can give you 100. But Nzinga Shaw was the chief diversity officer in the past for the Atlanta Hawks. She's now with Starbucks. She was instrumental in getting the leader, the owner of the Atlanta Hawks, to say, this is not something that needs to report to the CHRO or to HR. This is something that needs to report to you. You want more fans in that stadium, and I am going to work hard to build connection and ties to the LGBTQ community, to under-resourced and underrepresented young people, to veterans. She worked extremely hard to build networks and allegiance and alliances with organizations that were not showing up inside of the Hawks Stadium.
I think that, Torin, you hit so many things, and Luke, you did as well. I think chief diversity officers are a rare position. I think there are less than, you know, 500 or so in the United States that have a high level diversity title. And most of those titles are shared titles. I'm the chief talent officer and I'm the vice president of diversity and inclusion. And so many times the ways that we hear about corporate socialism and the touchy-feely things is because it's a novel position. It doesn't have a business strategy or a business tie to it. And when you see kind of the standalone CDO, that presents challenges that are unique as well, because that oftentimes ends up being a lot of PR activities, a lot of philanthropic activities. They lose that connection to talent acquisition and focus on internal culture building and internal training, and it loses its purpose and it just becomes an overhead. And so we have to find kind of the right mix of how D&I focuses on talent acquisition, how it focuses on growth and retention, and how then it speaks to the larger opportunities then to grow the employer brand through outcomes-based activities, right? If you're not hiring, you shouldn't be talking about hiring. You shouldn't be putting out cute commercials about how you love veterans, because if you're not hiring veterans, you don't love veterans. And I'm probably a little bit more of the hammer in this conversation, because amnesty is nice, but we need accountability and we need transparency. And right now companies are allowed to hide behind the wall of data collection and privacy and all those things. So we can't see the actuality, and we've allowed this club of awards and goodwill to take place of actual outcomes, as opposed to holding those accountable, and leaders who are doing D&I well, holding other leaders accountable and saying, don't take that pledge. We don't care about the pledge. We care about how many people you hired and how many people you helped grow through your organization. And that's really the conversation that we need to be having.
That's a really important point on the data collection side, because I can understand, you know, privacy advocates, let's say, using, you know, the privacy, using privacy as a barrier against this, because we're going to need to collect this information, aren't we? I mean, it's impossible to think about D&I, or at least you've got to measure it. If you're talking about accountability, for instance, and it's based on the actual things that are happening rather than the rhetorical stuff that's being broadcast, the only way to do it is to actually effectively measure. And that means that we have to make some compromises on people's privacy. I think, I mean, you tell me. I mean, I'm speculating here. What are your thoughts?
I don't know if we need to compromise on people's privacy. I think that, you know, most individuals are willing to self-identify in a number of different ways. Right here in the U.S. right now, we're going through our census period. We only do it every 10 years, and the push is to get people to actually participate in such. You know, we've had a number of conversations of what has been given up when we download these free apps in exchange for free and what they are collecting. And in many instances, we don't really know what they're collecting. I firmly believe, Hung, that if individuals knew that collecting said data, whatever that identifying data is, in an effort to build better, more inclusive, more representative teams, that most individuals, almost all individuals, would be willing to give up that information. I don't feel that is an invasion of privacy. I believe that we have all of the data that we need, and we don't need another report. We'll get more, but we don't need another report that needs to tell us why we should be doing D&I. Not another one. What we need is organizations saying, if you are a third-party agency and you want to work with us and be on our vendors list, we're not going to work with you if you don't have a solid D&I strategy. That's what we need. So we don't need organizations to do more of what they've been doing, neither to challenge the market in a different way and shift the narrative. If, in fact, you are a third-party agency and you want to work with my Fortune 1,500, 200 organization, if you want to work with us, then you must show us that you are going to, I mean, aggressively and demonstrably chase D&I in your presentation of talent. If you're not willing to do that, then you're not working with us. You can go work with someone else, but you're not going to work with us.
That's a really interesting, and I think this aligns with a point I wanted to bring back to you, Julie, because you mentioned it really early on in your comment about sort of the standards that vendors need to have before you engage with them. So I think this is the point, wasn't it, that you were trying to make, that Torrens just underlined. It reminds me a little bit of this interlocking. There's certain countries that have gone ahead and done this and made it legal. That these things are actually part of the legal infrastructure of doing recruitment. And that obviously brings its own conversations and its own issues also. But it's not an alien idea to say, you know what, every company that we deal with, we're going to score in some way based on their policies in these regards that we care about, and we're not going to deal with those companies unless they meet that mark. If you do deal with that company for whatever reason and they're below a certain mark, you might actually then descend to that level also. So I'm referring specifically to South Africa here, that have this Luke, I think you seem to be familiar with this, but
I had a few years recruiting in South Africa, and actually I think this is a really interesting example, because they have absolutely kind of hardwired their supply chain so that you have to be, you know, certain ownership, or and you will not win contracts without it. The bit though that I suppose I kind of sit on the fence a little bit still, but I guess I use my South Africa experience to guide me, is this topic around accountability. Because in South Africa, it is hardwired into law. And look, the 3 years I've recruiting there was that you had certain candidates you had to give preference to. You know, if you were looking for a finance manager and you had a black female against a white female, the black female trumped the white female. Like, there was a, you know, genuine hierarchy that you had to adhere to. It hasn't fixed the problem. So I guess kind of like, you know, I'm probably kind of somewhere between where Julie and Torin is around the, you know, yes, absolutely, we need to use the data, we need to work on it, we need to show it, we can't let people hide from it. But until we kind of get that individual to kind of want to make a change, because we hear the business case, but it doesn't seem to be resonating into action. So I'm kind of like, you know, kind of this reset bit is how do we do that in a way that we take what we know about accountability, take what we know about kind of speaking to someone's heart and mind around this being the right thing, and step forward, like this amnesty concept, I guess.
Go ahead.
No, you your go? Show, man. Go ahead.
It's my show. You're going ahead. Go.
Well, I mean, again, so to Luke's point, you know, just throwing something out, like spitting in the wind real quick in the moment. You look at some of these executive compensation packages, you know, $200-$400 million a year. Certainly, if you can claw back some of that money, if we can hold individuals accountable, and it's not a matter of hierarchical preference, it's a matter of truly looking at the data. So how many individuals did your business unit or your organization interview last year, or how many were presented, or how many were promoted? How many did we retain? How many did we lose? Why? I mean, if we look at all of that data, I'm sure these compensation experts, people that know the numbers, they can come up with a formula, a system. And I think that it's company specific. I don't think that there's one rule that works across industry. I just think that organizations can say, look, this is what will work for us. And if you do these things, we're going to compensate and reward you in this particular way. If you can't do these things, maybe we need to have a conversation. If you miserably fail at these things, and I mean, we know that it's intentional that you are not giving it any effort, then we probably need to have a discussion as to whether or not you really belong inside of our organization. Look, we're not making it so that an individual is measured based on just their race. I do not agree with what South Africa is doing in that regard. I want it to be an even playing field across the board. I don't want preferential treatment. But when you get on that starting line with Torin Ellis, if I blow your ass off the track, then I blow you off the track. If you blow me off the track, that's what it is. So I just want it to be very much so even. Put us all at the starting line. Let us do what it is that we do. Hold the individuals accountable. The person at the end of the race, you know who crosses that line first and best and fastest. That's the individual that you bring on your team.
Julie, I'm going to go to you very quickly, but one point to underline this that I thought that Torin made a very important point was, where do you apply the rule? And maybe what is the unit of analysis, for instance? Like, for instance, in South Africa, they've just rolled it across everyone. You know, that's like the top-down thing. Every single organization has to do this. And of course, it's such a broad brush. It may not be suitable in many contexts. But Torun, what you're saying is it needs to happen at the level of the company, and it needs to kind of be disciplined within a business. And it may look different according to a different organization based on their context, which I think is an interesting way to view it. Like, what is the unit of analysis that's important? Moving on to the reset, quote unquote. This is the sort of the main topic of this. Is COVID-19, does it give us a chance, as horrible as this pandemic as it is, and as no one would want this, no one still wants this, there's urgent issues already, people are dying, etc. But is it such a big system shock that it gives us a chance to rebuild from scratch? Julie, I'll go to you first on this.
I think it's such a big system shock that rebuilding is not going to be an option, but what we're going to see is the companies that really value diversity and inclusion as a business practice and as a impact to their community, and those that have been talking about it. And the biggest challenge for CEOs, CDOs for the next 2 to 3 years is going to be how they've had these conversations about diversity and inclusion and how we react when times get tough. And how we recognize the value of having diverse leadership and diverse workforce, a diverse board, and how that can now relate to a business conversation that has actual teeth and components to it. And we set a minimum set of standards to help achieve those goals from a business perspective. If it doesn't have resources, if it doesn't have commitment, then it's those companies we'll see that are just talking about it, those programs will die out. Those that are truly committed to it will actually continue to have resources and overhead that are devoted to diversity and inclusion. And I think, you know, from something that Torun and Luke hit on, you know, the starting line isn't the same for everyone. And I think that's important. I don't like the checkbox of ratios and all of those things. But when we're building processes, when we're hiring vendors, when we're looking at how we put assessments in place, for example, we have to understand that as a woman, my starting line is different than Torun's, and it's different than Hung's, and it's different than Luke's. As a person with a disability, it's different when my disability is hidden versus when it's visible. And we can't hold our vendors accountable, and we can hold ourselves accountable to make sure that we have created appropriate opportunity within the talent acquisition pipeline to make sure that people who have a different starting line are getting to the finish in a way that is both impactful for the business and for dealing with institutional inequities that companies have the opportunity to actually have it to change.
Yeah, you make a good point, Julie, and I'm so appreciative of you correcting me in that way. That is what equity is. You know, it's making sure that we put an individual at the appropriate starting line and then allow them. We support them. We give them the resources. We give them access to the support that they need so that they can do the job that they said they wanted to do and that we hired them to do. So thank you for that correction.
So building on this idea of potential reset, one of the features that we've seen in this pandemic is that suddenly we've had this fragmentation of the physical business. Like everyone's had to just work from home. We've sent everyone at home, no longer coming into the office, doing all that type of stuff. Is the distributed nature of work something that we can build on when we think about D&I, or is it just an incidental thing that isn't necessarily a significant factor to think about?
Say that again, Hung.
I didn't quite understand it myself, to be honest. let me try and speak English.
I mean, I just thought I would ask. That's all.
No, I guess what I'm saying is that okay? Are certain inequities based on the idea of co-located in-office work? I think absolutely right. Because imagine, like, one of the things that's definitely true was that when you're assessing someone, interviews, in-person interviews are a classic way of door opening, door shutting, right? I mean, do I like this person face to face? And I was always pretty good at converting interviews because, generally speaking, this is my comfort zone. But I can imagine someone who's got a different psychological neural profile to me. Actually, that's a huge barrier because it's really difficult. They're not comfortable in this face-to-face scenario, and yet they could be equally, or if not more, competent than me at the task at hand. Now, I think that in-person interview is intimately linked with the idea of a co-located office environment. Whereas if you're distributed and we're doing a call like this, and this is how we're working, actually, does that help? I mean, does it help someone, for instance, that isn't as comfortable in an in-person environment? The answer's got to be yes. So I guess what I'm saying is, right, everyone's working from home now. Let's imagine there's going to be a percentage of companies that like this and will persist and say, hey, this is the new normal for us. We're going to be more distributed. Maybe this becomes a long-term trend throughout. And if so, is that going to support or help the D&I sort of D&I generally? Is this an opportunity for us, this idea of distributed and remote work?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would hope so. In the article that you posted earlier around the levels to working remotely, great article. I actually shared it myself. He said that they have 1,700 or 1,200 employees in 75 different countries. So the assumption there is that he's got a great deal of representation and inclusion in the organization. Well, representation, I don't know necessarily the level of inclusion, but the point is, from an aesthetic standpoint, he's got the representation. I absolutely believe that if, in fact, we are genuine, and once again, we hold people accountable, if we say we are going to set a new norm, if we say that we are going to do this work differently post COVID-19, what does differently mean? Differently means no more taking orders from mediocre white men. What does different mean? No more taking orders only from people with privilege. What does different mean? Different means no more allowing Black and brown people to be complacent and silent. We got to get a different set of folks with minds that are sitting around the table making some of the decisions. And when you have that, you have people saying, you know what? Geospatial challenges have prevented a number of individuals from applying at our organization. Now that they don't have to come in, they don't have to ride a subway for 2 hours, catch 5 buses. They don't have to do those types of things. We can get them. We can get individuals that are moms who have retreated from the workforce because they were raising children, but they have an incredible amount that they can give to the workplace, and they can probably work from home. If they can't work from home 5 days a week, they can most certainly work from home 3 days out of the week. We can now go out after, you know, those individuals. We put up employer branding and messaging to target those individuals. So the answer is an absolute yes, but you have to be willing to do that. You have to have different people sitting at the table that says, this is what we want our organization to look like. We do not want it to look like what it's looked like over the last 1,000 years. And that doesn't mean that we are pushing white men out. It doesn't mean that we are pushing abled individuals out. It doesn't mean that we are pushing these people out. It simply means that we are creating an environment that has a representation that looks a whole lot different than it's looked over the last 10, 20, 30, 40, or 50 years. And those talented individuals will find an opportunity somewhere else, or they will start something new. We all can win.
Okay, thanks for that, Torrin. Very quickly, Julie, because we're running a little bit short on time, that question to you. Same one. Does distributed working, remote working as default, if companies shift this way, is this an opportunity for us to also shift these intractable issues that we've not been able to solve so far in D&I? Is it an opportunity?
I think for a lot of communities, it's a huge opportunity. For example, if you are coming into an interview in a wheelchair, and you know that there has been, through your experience, so much bias from you just rolling into an interview, and it's kept you from getting jobs that you're fully qualified to do, that playing field is level when we're interviewing remotely, when we're hiring remotely, when we're working remotely. It removes that bias component. for people who are traditionally going to be more successful in a home-based environment, but have had a hard time getting that accommodation because employers couldn't understand the technical infrastructure or the team infrastructure to be able to do that. They now have that technical infrastructure. They now have that leadership infrastructure to help a person who is going to perform better by working at home part-time, full-time, some of the time when they need to be able to do that, because that's not going to be an accommodation that we can just throw out the window anymore. And so I think this creates huge opportunity for women, for stay-at-home moms, for people with disabilities, for people with significant mental illness, to actually get into companies as they're hiring through these remote processes, and then to be able to appropriately ask for the right accommodation or environment for them to be successful. I think it's going to be great.
No, hopefully so. Luke, go to you with the same question. I mean, I think we're aligned generally here, but are there D&I challenges with remote businesses? Probably are, right? There's other types of challenges that perhaps that are emergent that we're not quite aware of right now. But maybe it is an opportunity to do something. It's a big enough shock. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, it's definitely a big enough shock. I think the challenge we've got is as many doors as it opens, I think it's going to close a lot of others. For example, those that are living in households where maybe they could go to work and they could dress a certain way and sound a certain way, and the economic disadvantage that they might have wasn't apparent. You try and now get someone to work remotely because that's the norm of the organization, and they're in a household, you know, where that's challenging or difficult to do. That's going to make it much harder for someone like that. So I think the big thing I see is that we've been given a pause, whether it was COVID-19 or otherwise, we've been given a pause that's allowing us to think deeply about some of these problems and challenges. It's giving a chance to come back in, reset and execute things in a different way. And even if we just took two or three of those things, like, you know what, I'm going to do more to focus on disability and neurodiversity, because actually I've my mindset belief around that being a challenge, I've actually got the headspace to go and build that and do that. You know, I'd welcome that. So I'd, you know, to any talent leader or talent org, I'd be saying, look, go fix a couple of things, go and do a couple of game changing things that actually with the headspace you've got now, you really have an opportunity to do it.
Yeah. Fantastic. Okay. Listen, I'm going to go very quickly to questions, folks. And because we are literally got 2 minutes, I'm not able to go around everyone. So I'm just going to ask a question and just throw it at one of you two. Okay. One of you three, should I say. So this one is from Daniel Shouten. Daniel asks, maintaining culture does it not create friction with the pursuit of diversity? Okay, so this is one of those, okay, does diversity actually create cultural problems? Let's say, you know, we're hiring for cultural fit. Remember that 3 years ago, that was the thing that we all wanted to do. And then we realized, oh, actually this may just be like hiring clones of people that are cultural fit. It's actually folks that look like us. A finished question is, because origin, culture, region, sex, etc., have a direct effect on your organization culture. So quite a controversial comment by Daniel there, but let's bring it back to the first question. Maintaining culture, does it not create friction with the pursuit of diversity? Julie, go to you with this.
If it is causing conflict, then you've got some culture problems and you need to start focusing on how to fix them. Simple as that.
Okay, I think that's answered. Excellent. Thank you, Julie. And thank you, Daniel, for the question. Okay, Torin, I'm going to go with you. And this is a super long question, so I'm not even sure I'm going to be able to read it properly, but let me give it a shot. This is from Nigel. I have experienced that businesses usually understand the starting point of diverse candidates, but when it comes to making a decision, they always go with someone who has all the technical skills and someone who may take some time to learn due to certain disability. This becomes challenging when the role is very critical and where diversity feels like not working. So in other words, what he's saying, well, I think what Nigel is saying, if I can just paraphrase, by the way, in future, please write a shorter sentence, a question, should I say? What he's saying is, look, people understand that an individual that isn't a typical hire may be coming from a different starting point. But when you've got a super critical business critical issue and time to hire is an important thing, you're going to go with the person that's going to deliver that thing more quickly, and then kind of leave D&I a little bit on the long grass. The question is,
I got it, hung. Don't you worry about it. Listen, I got it.
I don't got it, but you go and answer what I think I asked.
Here's the deal. The tone in which Nigel is talking is reactive. And that is what most recruiters are operating from. If, in fact, we are looking at time to fill and going after positions, most recruiters are working from a reactive standpoint. Position comes open. Now I decide to do what I need to do. That's tactical. I get it. Strategy-wise, you say to yourself, let me look forward and find organization or opportunities in the organization where we really don't have any representation. And let's put a plan in place to go after maybe a person with a disability or an individual that's not represented. So there's tactical recruiting, there's strategic recruiting. I encourage organizations to do both.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Torin. Nigel, I hope that answered your question. Okay, folks, we've hit our time and our hour. Thank you, everybody, for your time and with us. Sorry for the laggy camera I've got, by the way. I know it looks kind of weird. It's kind of been distracting me all the way through as well. What a fantastic conversation. Really enjoyed this. I'm going to share the links in the chat stream later on with everyone here. I'll send everyone an email also so you've got the access to these amazing guests that have been on the show. So let me firstly thank Judy Sowash. Thank you so much for coming on Brain Food Live. Yeah. Pleasure to have you here. Torin Ellis, a pleasure as always to get you on the show. We'll do this again for sure. And Luke Davis, thanks for being co-pilot and co-host for Brain Food Live on air. Okay, everybody, that's it for now, at least for another half hour, because I'm back on with round two of a double header, and it's with all my LinkedIn. How do we work LinkedIn? What are the changes in 2020? So again, follow the channel if you want to catch up with that. Otherwise, we'll see you next week. Okay, everyone.
Thanks.
Thank you.